Welcome to New Mexico in Focus, the podcast for Monday, June 12th, 2023. I'm Lou DeVizio. Let's get right into the headlines. A decision to protect Chaco Culture National Historical Park and the surrounding area from oil and gas drilling for the next 20 years is facing harsh criticism. Sunday, U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland was set to speak at Chaco Park to formally announce the decision that bans future extraction leases inside a 10-mile radius surrounding the historic site. But, according to reporting from the Albuquerque Journal, Navajo landowners gathered outside the planned event, blocking Haaland and others from entering. The protesters say Secretary Haaland's decision will cost them significant income and essentially landlocks their financial interests. Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin says the Biden administration decided on the buffer zone without considering the impact on the Navajo Nation's economy. He says it violates tribal sovereignty, too. The protest, by the way, seems to have been successful, in part anyway. Haaland and other tribal leaders who support the 10-mile buffer relocated to the Bureau of Indian Affairs office in Albuquerque. While there, the All Pueblo Council of Governors said they had joint discussions with Navajo Nation representatives several years ago, and that those talks prompted the withdrawal efforts. The state of New Mexico has reached a $500 million settlement with Walgreens over the pharmacy chain's role in distributing highly addictive painkillers. Last year, state officials argued at trial that Walgreens failed to recognize suspicious opioid prescriptions. That $500 million is on top of $274 million in settlements from Albertsons, CVS, Kroger, and Walmart. State attorneys say, in all, opioid litigation has brought in more than $1 billion. Nationally, over the past few years, companies with roles in opioid manufacturing, prescribing, and distributing have reached settlements totaling more than $50 billion with local, state, and tribal governments. Mind-blowing. That's how legislative analysts are describing New Mexico's revenue figures, saying they're outpacing previous spending at unprecedented levels. The latest report from the Legislative Finance Committee predicts an extra $581 million in state revenue over the last consensus estimate. That money is largely coming from an increase in oil prices and production. That's prompting members of the committee to warn the one-time funding will eventually dry up, and it will force lawmakers to decide whether to continue paying for healthcare, education, and other social programs that have been expanded during the production boom. Charles Sally, the LFC's interim director, says his staff will carry out another round of forecasts this summer that will look decades down the road, projecting the possibilities and constraints of increasing spending over the coming years. We start the podcast this week with an update in the case of a failed Republican candidate for the state legislature, now facing federal charges of election interference after prosecutors say he organized a series of drive-by shootings targeting Democratic lawmakers. This week on the Line Opinion Panel, Joel Myers joins us for the first time. He's an attorney and former federal prosecutor. Eric Griego is a Democratic former New Mexico state senator who now works as a policy advisor for Mayor Tim Keller in Albuquerque. And our final panelist for the week is Albuquerque Journal staff writer Dan McKay. Here's Gene.
Now we begin this week with an update in the Sullivan Pena case. Police arrested the former Republican candidate and party official in January, accusing him of orchestrating a series of shootings at the homes of four Democratic officials following his election loss in November. Now, federal authorities announced charges last week against Mr. Pena and two of his alleged accomplices. Those charges include conspiracy, interference with federally protected activities, fentanyl possession, and three counts of using a firearm in a violent crime. Now, if convicted, Mr. Pena faces a minimum of 60 years in prison. And Joel, let me ask you this first. Does that weight of that mandatory minimum sentence seem appropriate for what he's accused of doing, in your view?
It's high, because 60 years federally means 60 years. And I'm certainly not in any way trying to diminish the magnitude of what occurred. And you know, luckily, nobody was injured in the course of this. But 60 years is a real, real long time when you see some of the things. And what I think it points out mostly is a very disparate situation between state system and the federal system.
We're going to get to that. I appreciate you pointing that out.
So I think it's, I think it's high.
Actually, let me stop you there. Please, if you would, the difference, the first one that comes to mind, with the difference between federal charges and state charges here.
Well, the mandatory minimum is the first one that you point out. The 60-year mandatory minimum really means 60-year mandatory minimum, of which you'd have to serve at least 85% of that time.
Okay.
I don't do as much state practice, but I know they don't have similar mandatory minimums associated with that. He wouldn't be serving nearly as much time, and I think the credit for good time is calculated much differently in the states.
So. Gotcha. I appreciate that little bit of nuance there. Eric, is there possibly a narrative going on here that our state system is perhaps too soft or too weak compared to what we just heard from Joel about mandatory minimums and things for the federal side of things? It's a perception of our judges and stuff. Is it accurate in your view?
Well, normally I don't buy into that narrative. I have to say, in this particular case, given what we've seen in the legislature, even in a Democratic state, which has the fifth highest rate of gun crime in the country, the reluctance in both parties to do anything really substantial around gun violence.
Right.
But also, I do see this linkage with our democracy, right? And the fact that this is around an election. Again, typically I would say that seems a little bit harsh to me. I haven't always been crazy about using the federal standards for crimes, including some of the other sort of initiatives in Albuquerque around ATF and so on. In this case, when you have multiple people and sort of an orchestrated hit job, essentially, I happen to know a lot of these folks, they're colleagues. When gun violence spills over into elections and targeting candidates for the sole purpose that most of these folks had nothing to do with the election. They just happened to be in the room when stuff was certified. And one of them's a friend, and I saw the actual gun, the actual bullet holes. It's just, to me, it's beyond the pale. I'm not a lock them up and throw away the key. This particular instance, we have to send a strong message. And I do think we have to send a message to gun owners that this isn't just people knocking off liquor stores. This is really the lethality, the potential lethality in this case. This could have been really, really bad for our democracy.
I forgot to ask you, please let the folks know what you're doing right now.
For the next 2 weeks, in full disclosure, I've been advising the mayor on policy and working on a few issues in the city. On the mayor's team, I'm speaking for myself today. And moreover, I'm only there a couple more weeks, and so I'll be liberated. I won't be able to be here because I'll be out of the country for a year. Yeah. Hopefully not worry about gun violence.
That's true.
Part of the reason we won't be here. But but anyway, I'm speaking for myself, and I'm not representing the Keller administration.
Appreciate that. Absolutely. We've got a situation here, when you think about it, where the case has got a lot of publicity, Dan, as you know, from the start. And given the attention, I'm wondering if these incidents are getting a little bit more of a look since the January 6th situation. Does that make sense? Is there a connection here we can see or feel?
I think so. This case has certainly had an impact in the legislature. There's already been some push to make it easier for elected officials to keep their addresses confidential. This builds on sort of this ongoing concern. You know, our Secretary of State, the Chief Elections Officer in New Mexico, actually went into hiding, you know, after the last election around the January 6th time due to threats. So yes, there's tremendous concern over how this impacts policymakers and intimidation and disruption to the democratic process. You know, in terms of gun crimes and violence, you know, those are difficult problems to solve, but it's something that the legislature certainly is debating intensely.
Can I ask a favor of you? In our setup, Eric has reminded me, a lot of folks might not know how heinous this stuff was if you don't know the details of this crime. Just a quick recap, the four Democrats that were targeted, what happened there? What was Mr. Pena charged with here? And all that kind of a thing, just in a quick recap, if you would.
Well, drive-by shootings that that could have killed somebody, but didn't. So these are pretty terrifying crimes. You know, it's beyond just calling someone and making a threat. That's something that has happened to the governor, has happened to governor candidates, Republicans and Democrats. In this case, though, I mean, you're talking about something that really could have killed someone, and not just an elected official, but one of their family members.
That's right. It was very frightening. And like you said, there was stuff falling off the ceiling onto one of the victim's child in the bedroom. I mean, it was just very close. Joel, let me get back to something. I'm so glad you're here. Are there any constitutional concerns when you talk about federalizing what has historically been state crimes. There's been a little bit of agita, use a little New York word worth you there, about this. Is that overblown? What's your sense of that?
I think it's a tough position that both the state and the federal government are in, particularly in this city here.
Okay.
There's been tremendous overlap between federal and state crimes for decades now.
Right.
And now I think it's the executive officials that are choosing to use whatever resources they have available to them. So mm-hmm. I don't begrudge them on that. I do think there is more of a federalized creep into what would be local law enforcement issues. I don't necessarily look at this particular one, the Peña one, as confined to local law enforcement. I think it goes fundamentally to voting and election in this country. I mean, one of the things when I was struck by, you know, Eric's comments mm-hmm. are, just think of the tone at the top here.
Right.
When we're talking about just the sanctity of elections, does it come as a surprise to anybody that something like this would happen, be it in New Mexico or elsewhere, when we still have a presidential candidate who is peddling a notion of election fraud mm-hmm. taking place, I don't know how many, several years ago, when it's been debunked by even his closest members, but people see that, and that's what we're reading in the papers.
Well,
still
this guy
to
was inspired by it, apparently.
That's right.
I mean, he was regurgitating some of that stuff.
I just want to add one thing.
Please.
We're talking about guns and democracy here, and I can't miss the opportunity to say, in addition to this sort of really egregious, dangerous, over the top behavior, we have a fundamental problem with how our democracy works, and I think the gun issue is really demonstrating the flaws in our ability to pass meaningful policies that the majority of Americans want to keep people safe. This is not about elected officials. This is not about motorcycle gangs. I know we're going to talk about that. Mm-hmm. This is not about mental health. This is about guns. I James Carville had that famous line, it's the economy, stupid. It's the gun, stupid.
Right.
The common denominator in all
right.
of these things is not elections. It's not motorcycle gangs. It's not mental health. It's that all of these people were able to easily get firearms, regardless of their background, regardless of what state they lived in. And it's easier in some states than others. But I think we have a real problem, and we have to stop coming up with alternative explanations. It's really about the guns. Mm-hmm. It's about the guns, stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Eric,
exactly
just think
right.
about for a second, though, like the tension that you're talking about. It's a big tension between freedom and security.
Right.
And that's, I think, what we're really seeing, and the guns are the prime example of mm-hmm. it. And I know we'll talk more about some of the
That's true.
Supreme
Joel,
Court issues soon.
Let me ask you something I want Dan to pick up on as well, and that is the mayor, during his State of the City address, announced that he wants to make downtown Albuquerque a gun-free zone. This move would essentially send gun-related crimes in that area to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Any problems there as you see it, just in its general idea, not so much the details, but your sense of that?
I mean, I think we've been seeing it first starting with Heller in 2008, mm-hmm. Bruin last year, as far as this kind of individualized right to bear arms, mm-hmm. right, that for some reason took our nation over 200 years to recognize.
Right.
But now it seems so sacrosanct.
Right.
So, and we're seeing many, many challenges at the appellate court level, both federally and state, for any legislation that infringes upon this notion of an individual's right to bear arms, and that it must be grounded in some historical precedent.
Right.
Just 2 days ago, out of the en banc opinion, which means the entire Third Circuit invalidated a 922G prohibition for an individual who had a nonviolent, what would be considered a felony offense.
Interesting.
I said that was unconstitutional because there's no historical precedent to dispossessing nonviolent felons with guns. I think that is a watershed decision, which will most certainly be before the Supreme Court, as it's created a genuine circuit split. There's a mm-hmm. number of similar issues before our circuit and the Tenth Circuit. So mm-hmm. that's a long way of me saying that I do believe that regardless of the wisdom behind Mr. Keller's decision, mm-hmm. that there will certainly be challenges to that notion of can you restrict somebody's gun rights, be it in a particular, and if it's grounded based on some type of formal historical prohibition. And I'd be remiss to if I didn't state that somehow we're grounding kind of our modern day view on what people in the 1700s mm-hmm. thought as related to one particular new individual right.
That's right.
I think if we did that, there would be many, many people who wouldn't be voting.
That's right.
if we based it on some historical perspective.
Interesting
points. I believe slavery was still around in the 1700s as well.
That's right.
So I find it, you know, really disingenuous that we're grounding again. To you said it's the gun, stupid, and and maybe that is. Maybe that's what our country's
about. We'll pick that up.
The town of Red River is working to recover after a mass shooting that left 3 people dead, 5 others injured, and led to the likely end of one of the town's signature events. It's left a lot for Red River Mayor Linda Calhoun to manage. Gene caught up with her earlier this week to ask about the response from law enforcement and the future of Memorial Day weekend in Red River.
Mayor Linda Calhoun, Red River, we really want to thank you for spending a couple minutes with New Mexico PBS and New Mexico in Focus. Very first question, how has the community reacted now that we're a few days past? What's the general tone and tenor of Red River right now?
Everybody's beginning to recover. They're very relieved at the stance that the town has taken to not do anything to continue this rally or to encourage it. Mm-hmm. I just came from a meeting 30 minutes ago with a group of businesses that are working on, are putting together ideas as to how we can move forward and what the event can look like next year.
Mm-hmm. Now, just to make sure I'm clear on this, there is no motorcycle rally planned for next year. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
And of course, we all understand that we can't just flip a switch and it's gone. So we know it's going to take a few years to phase this out.
Right. Let me ask you about law enforcement and how they approached the situation. Had you had conversations with law enforcement previous to the rally and maybe perhaps some kind of warning from law enforcement that a bunch of these motorcycle guys are coming with bad intent? Was that a conversation beforehand?
We always talk about it because we always know that there's that that prospect of that happening. Mm-hmm. And so this year, what was a little bit different is when we had our first briefing with state police and all of the first responders and our local law enforcement, there wasn't a lot of chatter. And, you know, they're watching constantly for the intel to see how many we can expect. And as of Thursday night, we were expecting maybe 50 to 100 that would be showing up of the Banditos. And then as the day progressed, and we got more and more intel, we knew that there were going to be more.
Okay.
But we didn't expect 3,000 here on Saturday afternoon.
Mm-hmm. What was the
We were prepared, but we weren't expecting it.
I could imagine. Was there any, in your research and talking to your own law enforcement people, was there trouble anticipated that day? Had you been, anybody had a sense of it that something was going to happen that day?
I've talked to several people that said they just felt there was a sense that something was different.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when they had the gathering of 500 in Cuesta, which is 12 miles west of us, and they began to come up and we heard of more and more coming in, we began to get a little concerned. But my marshal had a meeting with their sergeant at arms on Saturday afternoon at 4:15. And was assured that everything was okay. And 45 minutes later is when this happened. So it was premeditated. They knew exactly what was going to happen, and they kept it very quiet.
Well, interesting. Las Vegas, New Mexico, just announced it's canceling its 18th annual Rough Rider Motorcycle Rally in July, and Berlin has decided to cancel its motorcycle. Have you talked to any other community leaders about this in New Mexico?
I briefly spoke to Berlin about theirs. I have not spoken to anybody in Las Vegas.
What was the sense of the conversation with the folks in Berlin? Were they concerned? What was the questions they got, you were being asked by the Berlin folks?
They were definitely concerned. They wanted to know what we were doing going forward to prevent it from coming back.
Yeah.
And just kind of wanting to know what happened, how we responded, how prepared we were. And talking about the retribution, which we saw the FBI officer talk about yesterday. And none of us want to set our communities up for some kind of incident like this where they're in danger.
Now, the plan is, my understanding, you're going to honor veterans next year. Tell us about that.
We've talked about bringing in music, some kind of food competition. all kinds of ideas. You know, we do events so well that I know we can do something, but we will be looking at all aspects of what attracted the game motorcycles, and all of that will be eliminated. Yeah. You know, the itinerant vendors that are selling the leather, the tattoo parlors, the patches, none of that will be allowed.
No colors, no. Okay, I hear your point there, because that's right. A big bone of contention inside.
And the
no
colors, that's really a big deal, because as a town, we can't ban colors. That's freedom of speech. And so the way we have to come at it is, we don't want anything that would be attractive to them to come here.
Gotcha.
You know, zero tolerance for any kind of motor vehicle violations, zero tolerance for parking in the middle of the street like they've always done. So that's the approach we're taking.
Mm-hmm. Mayor Calhoun, bit of a wild card question here, but if there was ever a system where you could screen for guns and have no guns in the facility, would you be open to hosting a motorcycle event at that point?
These people are very smart. They're going to get around. They're going to get around all of the laws any way they can. So I think we have to respect people and their individual rights. But our job is just to try and keep them safe.
The individual right to carry or to protect oneself, Second Amendment rights, of course,
exactly.
And right, exactly right. It is tricky. I realize that's a very tricky question because, again, who would show up if you had that? But the other problem is you don't want people showing up with firearms. Is there a way to do these things without firearms? Just in not just your event, but just your personal opinion. Where do guns fit into this whole thing? And is there a way to eliminate them from this kind of a situation?
Well, you know, that falls on the individual business owners, and our bars definitely ban weapons, and they do body searches and they take them away from them. But you have to understand, this happened in the middle of Main Street.
Right.
This was not in a business. This was the middle of Main Street. So I think we handled it the best we could. We planned for the situation. We had 36 state police here. We had our four officers. We had sheriff's deputies from Moore County and Taos County. So mm-hmm. We had EMTs, EMS on standby. We responded within 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a matter of whether they had the guns or not. This was a planned criminal gang shooting.
Thanks again to Red River Mayor Linda Calhoun for speaking with us. And welcome back to our Line Opinion panelists. As Mayor Calhoun told us, there's a serious talk of ending the Red River Memorial Day motorcycle rally after 41 years. Officials in Las Vegas and now Berlin have announced, Las Vegas announced their Rough Rider motorcycle rally in July is canceled, and Berlin canceled theirs as well. Is that the right call, Dan? Should other local leaders consider canceling future events like this? I mean, it's a personal opinion question, but given what we've seen in the news, if you're a mayor, why would you have a motorcycle rally in your town right now?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's my role to give advice to mayors about, mm-hmm. you know, what sorts of events they should run. But I mean, it is pretty sad that that it comes to this, given that there are so many people who enjoy these events, who, you know, are not carrying weapons, not getting in trouble, mm-hmm. you know, who enjoy New Mexico scenery and, mm-hmm. you know, the social aspect of it. It's certainly disappointing to see it come to an end if that's what's happening.
Right. You know, Eric, there's a lot of local folks up there who have been quoted in the papers as saying this was bound to happen at some point. Taos County Undersheriff Jerry Hogriff, quote, "Some of you up here may have heard me say this 20 years ago when I was still working on this rally. It's like sitting on an open powder keg with a lit cigarette." It's an interesting quote, isn't it?
Well, you know, here's the thing. Motorcycle rallies happen across this country as if for 40, 50 years plus. There's nothing unique to them. I haven't seen any research that said there's this strong correlation between motorcycle gangs and active gun violence. You may not like that they are rowdy and there's probably some fighting going on. Again, I was disappointed in the mayor's response, because she was asked sort of directly, is this about the rally? Is this about banditos? Is this about alcohol? Or is this about guns?
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that caused the shootings was the guns. I mean, there was alcohol involved and bad blood. You know, there's been bad blood among motorcycle gangs
right.
at time immemorial, like,
that's
and
right.
they fight it out. Maybe there's some knives involved. But the level of violence, gun violence, and actual lethal results again, it's not about motorcycle gangs. It's not about beefs between certain groups. It's not about the countless rallies that happen. It's not about motorcycles. It's about the guns. And even in this community where a mayor's having to deal with the aftermath, she couldn't muster, given the politics in that part of the state, she couldn't muster the will to say, like, maybe we got to think about the gun stuff. The denial that we hear from so many of our elected officials at all level is like, well, it's got to be mental health. Maybe it's the gangs. Maybe it's the drugs. Maybe it's something else. You know, bottom line is people wouldn't have been shot if there weren't guns involved.
That's right. Joel, I'm curious from your end of the world how you see things like this. Meaning, let's assume everybody that comes to the motorcycle rally or a good percentage has a gun for protection. Do you see that differently as opposed to like a private citizen trying to protect themselves? Because we have people claiming self-defense here. But the self-defense people also shot people in self-defense. Sure. So to Eric's point, if everybody has a gun, how do we manage this kind of thing from your end of the world?
I think you do. I mean, I agree exactly what Eric's saying. It's the gun, stupid. Now, I don't understand the difference between a private citizen and, you know, a motorcycle gang member, because I believe they're probably private citizens as well, right? So you have the right of association of people. Right. And I think if we've given out this very broad Second Amendment right to people, I don't know how you could stop it. Right. One of the things I was somewhat concerned about when the mayor was saying is that while they're not going to have the official rally, she doesn't believe it's going to end for some time either, that people will still go. I mean, there's the right of association people have, and they'll go, and that creates, I think, some type of law enforcement dilemma. That's see, they faced a dilemma here when they had, it seemed to be that they had some at least advance warning about the amount of people that were going to show up there.
That's right.
And that perhaps the law enforcement response was not commensurate to that. Mm-hmm. Now, what happens when you don't have an official rally?
You can't put police at the border and turn them away.
Of course not.
Without, you know.
Of course not. But what's the presence like going to be there? And I also feel for the other law-abiding citizens of Red River, the economic impact that this has.
Let's get to that. Dan, interestingly, Red River marked the second mass shooting in our state in less than 2 weeks, as you know. And the Taos County Sheriff's Office, where did the breakdown come? I read something, they had 35 officers standing by, but they also knew there were hundreds, if not in the thousands, of these bandidos headed our way from Texas Highway Patrol, had told us this. Was there, in your sense of it, the breakdown between the amount of law enforcement present? Maybe it was everybody available, who knows, you know, but something didn't quite match up here. What's your sense of that?
One problem that kind of pops up throughout the state is coordination among these different agencies. And you have tension sometimes between sheriffs and cities. And it sounds like there was some dispute that also involved money, you know, were the sheriffs going to be paid overtime, this kind of thing. You know, these are tricky things that go across jurisdictional lines. I will say that one thing that comes up in the legislature repeatedly is they do hear about the deterrent effect of police officers rather than longer sentences. You brought up mandatory minimums earlier. Yeah. So, you know, in terms of the policy experts who testify before the legislature, they tend to emphasize a visible presence of police officers, the number of police officers. Rather than longer sentences. You know, the answer to this particular situation or what happened in Farmington, you know, I'm not sure what the easy policy solution would
be. Good point. That's a fair way to finish that thought because nobody really knows. Eric, what would, pick up on Dan's point here because this has come up a lot, what would a proper police presence look like in something where you've got hundreds of bandidos coming, you've got other motorcycle groups coming, you've got limited intel, let's just assume. It doesn't mean everybody in the entire state police force needs to be there. I mean, what's the appropriate response for law enforcement?
You know, not to sound like a broken record, but I feel like we get into these alternative sort of explanations. And, you know, you can have a huge show of force.
Right.
Remember, police are armed too, and police are human. And there's also, decent arguments to be made that when there's it's been made in even our downtown, when there's this sort of feel of tension because of police presence, that has sort of had a reactive, drugs or alcohol and lots of armed people to that equation, and it almost becomes inevitable that somebody Sometimes it's a cop having to shoot somebody, which happens a lot in our city and all across the country. Mm-hmm. So I'm just not convinced that I feel like we are continually grasping at alternative explanation, alternative hypotheses around what's happening. The answer is, look, we could have had the National Guard there,
right.
And there might have been some shootings because they're all armed.
That's
now,
exactly
we've
right.
We've decided as a society we want law enforcement, we want our military, which goes back to the constitutional sort of question. I think people disagree on what that the intent was. I happen to believe that we've completely misread that, and not by accident. I think it's been an orchestrated effort over many, many decades mm-hmm. by an industry that benefits from this, mm-hmm. and frankly, a broken political system that allows that to happen. But the point is, I do not believe that more cops, better cops, more uniformed cops necessarily would have changed the outcome here,
okay.
as it hasn't in Farmington, as it hasn't across
That's
the
right.
country.
That's right.
Because at the end of the day, you don't know who's armed, you don't know how they're going to react, you don't know what they're on, you don't know what
That's
the
right.
record is, because we've just decided to allow anyone, mm-hmm. pretty much anyone in most states, to have a weapon.
That's right. Joe, real quick, does the FBI play a role in assisting local law enforcement in these things? Is there anything shared traditionally? How does that work?
Oh, absolutely. I know there's a number of task forces. I know one of the senior agents who had testified at the hearing up in Taos is
right.
a subject matter expert on this. I've worked with him for many years. So they do have a very big support role, particularly here mm-hmm. in Albuquerque. I know they have a violent yep. gang task force mm-hmm. that's very, very active, both in state court as well as in federal court.
Mm-hmm.
So they do play this kind of overall caretaking and coordination responsibility. I think they do a very
yeah.
admirable job of doing so.
Good stuff. Dan, you touched on this a little bit earlier, but I do want to touch on what the possibilities for the next legislative session, given all that we've had, and thinking about what did or did not pass, particularly last year, this past session, I should say, and the session before that. Are we goosed into another frame of mind here with all these incidents? Does Red River contribute to this idea that we may perhaps need to do something about guns a little more vigorously here?
It could. It's hard to say exactly, what the political dynamics will be this next session. But, to Eric's point, the legislators have been, they have been sort of engaged in this conflict over firearms and trying to balance what they believe they're allowed to do by the law, mm-hmm. What is feasible politically. In terms of proposals that I think that we'll hear will be, proposals to restrict AR-15 style firearms.
Right.
That doesn't mean it'll get through. The legislature has had a lot of trouble defining what is an assault
right.
weapon.
Right.
There has been some movement towards a waiting period, like a 14-day waiting period, which is intended to make sure that background checks get completed. There's the potential of raising the age limit to
mm-hmm.
21
mm-hmm.
For certain firearms.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the kind of proposals we'll probably see, but the legislature can be hard to predict. They argue about the same thing for a really long time, and then one year it happens.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to know what'll happen, but yeah, I mean, it's impossible to imagine that this will not be part of the debate.
Yeah. Joel, in 10 seconds or less, is it AR-15s or handguns the problem? Meaning, is it the bigger weapons or the smaller weapons? That's the bigger problem in your world.
I think they're both
okay.
a problem, but I mean, just think about the amount of bullets you can shoot with a bigger gun with
right.
an assault rifle.
That's
so
right.
for something like that, I think it's fairly easy to determine that, but overall, I mean, we have 300 million or so guns or more than that in this country, even with a 14-day waiting ban.
That's right.
What are we gonna do now, and until we have a real reckoning with this, with our relationship with firearms, these are all just going
to
be similarly one-day news stories.
To Eric's point earlier,
on.
That's right. Thanks again to our Line Opinion panelists.
With violent crime burning up the headlines, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham is looking back 50 years for part of her plan to bolster public safety, bringing back a commission to address organized crime. Here's Gene in the panel one final time this week.
First created in the early 1970s, the Governor's Organized Crime Prevention Commission will focus on drug cartels and other groups driving the crime rate here locally. And Dan, you wrote a terrific article for the Journal summing up the details of this new commission. It's a list of familiar names, DAs, a former Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court, U.S. Marshals, and others. We were talking at the table a few weeks back about New Mexico's leaders' impulse to create another commission or task force every time there's a big issue here. But we have one. What's the deal? What's your sense of how the administration views this as potentially effective against crime here in the state?
Well, this commission could be a little more than just a task force or a blue ribbon panel. It does have some, it's been in statute for decades. Right. It has some subpoena power. It has some specific authority. At the news conference, the governor spoke a lot about the messaging. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult to say what the panel is actually going to do, whether it is intended to send a message to organized crime. Right. I don't know, I don't have the expertise to say whether that kind of thing is effective or not, but right. I think it kind of remains to be seen how it develops, and it looks to me like Sam Bregman, the district attorney, mm-hmm. who was appointed to his position by the governor, I think he's gonna have a lot to do with whether this thing succeeds or not.
He's heading the commission? Do I have that right, Mr. Bregman?
I don't remember who specifically is the chairman, but yeah. He seems to be the driving force behind it. Okay. It's pretty clear that this is something that he wanted to do and that he thinks can be effective.
Interesting. I'm curious, Senator, did this ever come up when your time in the legislature to reboot this commission?
I don't remember it. I don't remember it. Maybe it's things given how where crime has been, more recently. I mean, we certainly had, some challenges back then. Yeah. There's a similar effort.
Why now?
The crime rates are, I think that's driving a lot of it. But I do think there's been an honest recognition that federal, state, local, judicial and sort of law enforcement, frontline law enforcement, that there has to be a kind of better coordination. I mean, there's been initiative that what happened here around just getting everybody together. What I noticed in this last legislative session is you did have DAs and even public defenders and even advocates trying to come to some common ground on what are we going to do to tackle some of these crime problems. It's typically been around behavioral health and drug, we don't have that kind of, sadly, consensus around gun policy. I wish we did, mm-hmm. but I think there's this feeling that a lot of finger pointing. The judges are too lenient, and we're letting these guys out. There was a big, we didn't get any traction around the sort of pretrial detention legislation again. Mm-hmm. Wherever folks were out on that, I do think there is this lack of coordination, sometimes turfiness, but I do think that this is another example of a sincere effort. I hope it's sincere, mm-hmm. to get better coordination in terms of which tools and which parts of our criminal justice system and law enforcement we need to sort of better coordinate and better work, sort of mm-hmm. row in the same direction to sort of, if we're going to address any of these crimes, certainly if the fentanyl epidemic, but also the gun epidemic.
Mm-hmm. Joel, interestingly, speaking about tools that Eric just mentioned, this commission has subpoena power and the ability to initiate investigations. That's a little bit different than usual commissions and such. Does that give you a little hope for this, or?
Well,
or is that a, is
I think
that a
I'm
tool?
Kind of the eternal optimist, and I admire the governor and for resurrecting this commission. I have great deal of respect for some of the members on the commission.
Sure.
I've worked with a number of them for many years, particularly uh-huh. the U.S. Marshal. I have a great deal of respect for, and I enjoy the fact that there is a coordinated effort, subpoena power. I mean, the local agencies and the federal agencies already had subpoena power. I don't know how much that truly adds to it.
Now, let me ask you, let me stop you there. Do we have a potentially crossing of somebody needs to stay in their lane here when it comes to investigations? Who wins out? Is this this commission, the feds?
Hey, I think that would be a great problem that we had.
There you go.
Right, that we had enough law enforcement that the agencies are fighting to bring these necessary prosecutions and coordinated effort.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's the result of this, that we don't know who, of whether it's the locals or the feds who take it, mm-hmm. I think that would be a great problem to have, because it means at least we've met or come close to meeting our objective here.
That's right.
If I can jump
please.
In on what Joel
yeah.
said, it looks to me like the commission ran into a problem 40, 50 years ago because of some of these questions you're raising. There was some tension between the attorney general
right.
and this commission.
Right.
Raul Torres, the attorney general this year, was present at the news conference, so maybe that won't be an issue, but you may have hit on something that may be a challenge.
But Dan, he's not on the commission. Is there a reason for that, for Raul Torres to not be there?
I don't know. He was present at the commission or at the news conference.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear that he seems willing to assist and to help, and mm-hmm. carry it out. So
mm-hmm.
so we'll have to see. Hopefully these coordination problems have been
solved. He's got other stuff on his plate, as they say, too. So
solved.
Figured out. Exactly right. Eric, let me talk to you. Continuing with Mr. Bregman here, he says the commission will mix of public and private meetings. And if this group gets transparency phobic, as we tend to do sometimes here in New Mexico, What does that mean? Does it have to be fully transparent? Do we have to know what these guys are talking about every minute? Or do they need some space to do their thing if they're going to have subpoena power and all this other kind of stuff?
Well, our experience with the sort of the Metro Crime Initiative, which is very similar at the local level, was there mm-hmm. were the official public conversations, which were useful and I think productive. And then there were a lot of behind the scenes conversations that maybe happened in a way that was, you know, could pass legal muster in terms of transparency and so on.
Right.
Part of the problem is there's not enough of those. I'm not in law enforcement and I'm not in the judiciary, so but what I've heard from colleagues is that sometimes we assume that prosecutors and frontline law enforcement and others are talking to each other a lot more than they are.
Right.
Not to mention, you know, sort of the other side, you know, the public defenders. Like there is this need for a safe space for people to try to solve problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, let's be honest, a lot of these conversations are going to happen offline, as they probably should, you know, because if you really, there's a lot of really important and sensitive stuff that needs to be, there needs to be a place for folks who are trying to solve these problems to be able to communicate in a productive way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm all about transparency, but, you know, I think there's a place for that. There's also a place for sort of, you know, how do we get to a bottom of a case or a particular issue we're facing, you know.
Joel, real quick, I want to bounce back to you and I want to get to Dan as well. How does this impact, or this commission rather, potentially impact the mayor's plan about using federal lawsuits about, not lawsuits, but federal statutes regarding guns and violence downtown Albuquerque? Any cross there potentially you could see in your mind's eye?
It's hard to see. I guess if it's focused on this organized criminal effort, then I do think you would see some overlap, because a lot of the gun problem, particularly I think that we have here in Bernalillo County, is more of a organizational effort. And, you know, hopefully there'll be that crossover. I do believe that you know, the feds will work closely with this commission, as I think it should.
Yeah.
But I'm just struck by the fact that, hey, they're trying to do something. We're not just sitting back here and not making efforts to address these real serious problems. I wish them luck doing it, but it's a for effort at this point.
Yeah, exactly right. Dan, you talked about this a little bit, the makeup of the commission itself. Does the makeup inform how it might act when it comes to these kind of things? I mean, there's a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of gung-ho, everybody wants to contribute, certainly, but they all have backgrounds that we know about, all these individual folks. Any sense of the collective group, how they might act here?
No, I don't know.
That's a
you know,
hard one.
Sam Bregman is sort of, you know, my impression is he's a very strong personality.
Right.
I think that he is definitely going to be a big voice in this commission. But there, you know, there's also the U.S. Marshal. There are there's a police chief from kind of a smaller community. They've got some different voices here. You know, big city and rural, federal and state.
Right.
So. We'll see how it comes together.
We'll see who drives it, so to speak.
I just want to add a quick point.
There's
two other things I think we have to think about realistically, right? Mm-hmm. One is many of these positions are elected positions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think some of these folks may have some other things they're thinking about, not to suggest that.
I'm hearing you.
What Sam's up to. But
sure.
The other thing is there are serious resource questions here, and this isn't a lack of will to try to cooperate, but we learned in trying to do some of the funding piece of this in this last session that despite our genuine effort to coordinate and collaborate, you know, at the end of the day, there's a lot of resources that are really kind of, you know, there's a big battle for resources.
Right.
If you want to do, you know, we wanted to chase more warrants, and we had to really work with the rest of law enforcement to figure out, you know, how are we going to carve up this, you know, this overtime pay to chase the warrants. And it's been challenging,
absolutely.
You know, because people need, everybody could use more resources, right? The courts, the DAs, the public defenders, certainly frontline law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not always as, I mean, there's the picture of coordinating, working together, standing together, and then there's like, who's going to get the
that's
money
right.
to do their job,
I wonder,
right?
if this commission's going to be somewhat of a de facto advocacy group. If they're the ones to be able to go to the legislature and say, hey, in order for us to do this effectively, you're going to have to fatten everybody up here.
That would be great.
Saying. Exactly
that would be
right.
Great.
I want to say thanks again to this line panel. Terrific stuff this week. Let us know what you think about any of the topics these folks covered on our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram pages, and catch any episode you may have missed on the PBS app, your Roku, or Smart TV.
Thanks to Gene and the panel and everyone else who contributed to the podcast. The idea of federalizing state crimes was a major theme for us this week. If you want to read more about it and the questions it raises about our legal system here in New Mexico, I urge you to read the New Mexico in Focus newsletter from this past week. Executive producer Jeff Proctor lays out the pros and cons. You can sign up for the NMIF newsletter at nmpbs.org. You can also hear from Jeff in a special episode of the podcast later this week. He sits down with Gene to introduce himself to New Mexico in Focus viewers, revisit some of his past work in Albuquerque, and lay out his vision for NMIF moving forward. I think it gives some great insight into his approach to journalism, and it will give you a good idea of where we're headed here at NMPBS. I'm really happy to be a part of it. Thanks again, everyone. Please keep an eye on our social media pages. That's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube throughout the week. We'll be posting updates and other news items leading up to our show Friday night. Thanks again, everyone. I'm Senior Producer Lou DeVizio for Monday, June 12th, 2023. This is New Mexico in Focus, the podcast. Have a great week, everyone.